Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, the long-running soap opera All My Children is ending its run, and Susan Lucci bids farewell to her character, Erica Kane. A new documentary produced by Jamie Foxx tells the story of a Texas high school band that became famous and recorded albums in the 1970s. 35 years later, it's reunited to honor its bandleader. And Scott Simon interviews the author of Moneyball, the best-selling book-turned-movie about the Oakland A's general manager and how he changed the way baseball teams get assembled. But first...
This morning, one of the longest-running programs on television comes to an end. The soap opera All My Children will have its final broadcast. Fans have been following the people of Pine Valley on ABC television Mondays through Fridays since 1970. All My Children, or as the fans say, AMC, will be replaced next week with a talk show about food called The Chew. The network says the new program is informative and authentic and centers on transformation, food, and lifestyle. It is also considerably cheaper for ABC to produce than a drama with lots of characters, sets, and writers. NPR's Linda Wertheimer talked with actress Susan Lucci, the soap opera's founding mother, about her 40-plus years with All My Children.
Susan Lucci is the most famous actress in daytime drama. She plays Erica Kane, and most of the action of All My Children swirls around Erica. When ABC decided to cancel All My Children, Susan Lucci was very unhappy about that decision and very angry. She wrote about it in the paperback version of her memoir.
I went through the whole range of human emotions of sadness and disbelief and some anger. Also, how it kind of messed with my sense of self-worth as a performer and my journey through that. And at the end of the day, as I say in the chapter, I'm filled with gratitude.
Erica Kane, Pine Valley, AMC have been huge in Susan Lucci's life. She stepped into the role when the program began, when Erica was a tempestuous 15-year-old girl.
I had just graduated from college the year before. I was 22.
I want to be special, and I'm going to be.
What you're going to be is miserable if you keep expecting everybody to fall in line with your ways.
Hey, are we having a hamburger or another attack on Erica?
Do you have to be the one that everybody likes best to make sure that they like you at all?
Yes.
I know the scene. It was with Chuck Tyler.
You began as you went on, I must say. Erica continued to be a character who always wanted to be the center of attention. Was it a good role for you?
Oh, I think Erica Kane was a spectacular role for any actress to play, and I felt so lucky to be the one who got to do it. So to find on the part of a 15-year-old girl that was that juicy and had that much potential, I really thought Erica Kane had the possibility to be a modern-day Scarlett O'Hara.
Erica gave Lucci lots of room to hone her craft. Agnes Nixon, who created the program and many other soaps, gave Erica lots to do. She had an abortion right after Roe v. Wade made that legal. When Nixon decided she wanted to write a gay character into the program, she said that character would have to be Erica's daughter because Erica was the most popular character on the program and Lucci could handle it. Susan Lucci says that the role she's played for 40 years was not exactly Sophie's choice, but it was pretty sensational.
You know, I got to do the romance and I got to do the ladies' room brawls and the knockdown dragouts and all of that. So I got to play a lot of range within that part.
Now, millions of people in this country feel that they are intimately acquainted with you and your life as Erica, and even your real life. But there are two things that even people who are not well acquainted know, and that would be Erica by the numbers. I would say the numbers would be 11 and 19. What is 19?
What a great way to ask that question. Thank you. 19, well, it has to do with the Emmy. On my 19th nomination, I did finally win the Emmy for Best Actress, and I was just so amazed to win and so thrilled to win. I loved being nominated, and I made no secret about that. It's really a rush to be nominated by your peers in the industry. But winning is the best. Winning is better.
The streak is over, Susan Lucci!
Lucci came to the stage and the audience kept clapping. Many of the people there were in tears, including her fellow nominees. Lucci held the Emmy in both hands, a white-knuckled death grip. Susan Lucci wanted that long-awaited moment to last.
Thank you so very much. I truly never believed that this would happen. I wasn't meant to get this award before tonight, because if I had, I wouldn't have that collection of poems and letters and drawings and balloons and chocolate cakes you made me all this time to make me feel better.
The other Erica Kane number, 11, represents the number of times that Erica has married, almost always in some breathtaking bridal gown that might make even Kate Middleton jealous. But Susan Lucci has been married to the same man for more than 40 years. She has two grown children. She's a grandmother. I asked her if her family had to explain to new friends, "My mom is not really like that."
When my daughter was about 5 years old, one summer day, she looked at me and she said, "Mommy, how do you act like Erica Kane?" And she tossed her little hair like Erica did. And I was just so thrilled that my daughter saw the difference. she knew there was a difference. That made me feel so happy.
When Erica and the denizens of Pine Valley take their final bows today, it may not be the final end. AMC may move to the web, and Susan Lucci may move with it.
My heart is certainly there with Agnes Nixon, with all my children, with Erica Kane, with our incredibly passionate viewership, our fans. I would love to, and we are trying as we speak to work that out. I'm just waiting for a response at this moment.
Now on Monday, should you turn on the TV at the old familiar time slot, instead of All My Children, you'll get The Chew. And instead of soaps, you'll have salad.
Now here's another great little tip. To dress a salad, never pour the dressing right over top of your greens.
Linda Wertheimer, NPR News.
Missionary Sam Childers, baseball manager Billy Bean, and food writer Nigel Slater, they're all guys you could have a cup of coffee with if you were in the right place at the right time. They're also guys who are being impersonated by actors this week in new movies, which gives our film critic Bob Mondello a biopic triple feature to review.
One film is affecting, one is effective, and one's a little affected. Start with the affecting one, Machine Gun Preacher, the story of how Sam Childers, a drug-dealing biker gang thug, got religion and ended up doing charity work in war-torn Sudan. Charity work involving children, once a soldier shows him a stream of what he calls night commuters flowing into towns to sleep on the street.
Their parents send them out because it's safer to sleep here than in their own homes.
Why?
Because death comes at night in the villages. These are the lucky ones so far. The ones the rebels haven't found yet.
Does this sound like a standard heartstring tugger? Well, it would probably get pretty thick if someone besides Mark Forster were directing. Forster is the guy who made Monsters Ball, Stranger Than Fiction, and the most recent James Bond flick. Sentimental isn't really his thing.
Get a little book there and do whatever it is you gotta do,
Sam,
to get me that
mom.
Don't tell me to calm down!
Like its angry, abrasive leading man, Machine Gun Preacher is too tough to beg for tears, which may be why they flow so easily in the Cineplex. The folks behind Moneyball have no objection to tears if they're of the, oh my God, we're winning variety.
What is happening in Oakland?
It defies everything we know about baseball.
In telling the story of the 2002 Oakland A's and Billy Bean's struggle to pull them out of the cellar without a big recruiting budget, the film employs screenwriters who've penned everything from Schindler's List to Social Network. No surprise, then, that its approach is more writerly, spare, and efficient. Take this exchange between Brad Pitt and statistics-loving player evaluator Jonah Hill, who comes to his first day on the job with a thick stack of computer printouts.
I asked you to do three. How many did you do?
47.
Okay.
Actually, 51. I don't know why I lied just then.
Do you hear how much character information just got squeezed into 24 words? Tobacco-chewing Pitt, laid back and kind of jokey. Nervous Hill, so eager to please. It's the relationship between these two guys, not what they make happen in the infield, that drives Moneyball.
Hi, Mr. Schott. It's Peter Brand. I apologize for putting you on hold earlier. Billy asked me to call you back. He's on another line.
Don't we want $225,000 for Rincon?
Billy says he needs $225,000 for Ricardo Rincon. Please. Yes, I added the please at the end.
You needn't know much about America's pastime to understand the inside baseball chatter. Moneyball isn't as emotionally affecting as some biographical tales, possibly because its Billy Bean is kind of distant, hard to get to know. But in terms of laying out what the man did and what he meant to the game, it's both entertaining and effective. Which brings us to Toast, a film aclef about a budding chef, Nigel Slater, who grew up in a home where cooking wasn't Mom's strong suit. Still, a foodie finds comfort where he can.
No matter how bad things get, it's impossible not to love someone who made you toast. Once you've been through that crusty surface to the soft dough underneath and tasted the warm, salty butter, you're lost forever.
Hear that crunch? The food in Toast is downright tactile, from the gloppy canned stuff that Mom cooks to the mouth-watering pies prepared by a cleaning lady who more or less moves in after Mom dies, much to Nigel's annoyance.
You're wasting your time. I mean, you're far too common. And anyway, you're married.
All I'm doing is darning his socks.
Cleaning lady Mrs. Potter is played with delicious crassness by Helena Bonham Carter, and as Nigel grows older, life in the house they share becomes a bake-off for Dad's affections.
That's the best lemon meringue you've ever tasted. That's the best lemon meringue anybody's ever tasted. If I was you, son, I'd give up. You'll never even be in the vicinity.
What did you put in there to make it so fluffy?
Toast is a fictionalized version of what was apparently a score-settling memoir by Slater, and judging from the way it dishes about his dad and Mrs. Potter, he's still feeling bruised. All three films got input from the men they're based on, but Toast is the only one that leaves a bitter aftertaste, as if the filmmakers forgot that even the most savory dish, on table or on screen, can use a little sugar. I'm Bob Mandela.
Baseball is a money game. Year after year, the teams with the biggest payrolls, the Yankees, the Red Sox, now the Phillies, make the playoffs. I know that doesn't explain how the Chicago Cubs have the third highest payroll and finish last, but the teams with the smallest payrolls often see their biggest stars just go off to the richest teams. The new film, Moneyball, the Oakland A's general manager, portrayed by Brad Pitt, puts it this way to his scouts.
There are rich teams, and there are poor teams. Then there's 50 feet of crap. And then there's us.
But for at least a few years in the 2000s, the Oakland A's confounded that by adopting a new way of looking at the game and recruiting players nobody else wanted. Brad Pitt plays Billy Bean, the man who shook things up for the Oakland A's and for baseball. Bennett Miller directed Moneyball. He joins us now from Los Angeles. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I've read that you weren't particularly a baseball fan when you were approached.
You know, I was when I was a kid, and I liked to play, and I had memorized everybody's stats. And at about age 13 or 14, I think it was, it became clear that I was not going to be a baseball player. And my math teacher at the time was the coach of the freshman team in my high school, and I tried out and did not make it. But he made me the scorekeeper and the stat keeper.
But, oh my word, I mean, how apt this is for this film, because, of course, at the center of it in many ways is a character who you've named, renamed Peter Brand, actually based
right.
on a real man. He's a number cruncher, played by Jonah Hill, a young, bespectacled Yale economist. He gets hired away from the Cleveland Indians.
I wanted you to see these player evaluations that you asked me to do.
I asked you to do three.
Yeah.
How many did you do?
47.
Okay.
Actually, 51. I don't know why I lied just then.
And he says you can sweep out a lot of the stats by which we usually assess ball players. We have another clip.
Why don't you walk me through the board?
I believe there's a championship team that we could afford because everyone else undervalues them, like an island of misfit toys.
So where did they look for the misfit toys in Oakland?
One thing that the A's did was turned to ideas that were outside of professional baseball. And a fellow by the name of Bill James, who in a 70s and the 1980s, wrote a series of what he called abstracts, which were analyses of the game that were rejected by, you know, the Church of Baseball. And he at the time had been a night security guard at the Stokely Van Camp Pork and Beans factory. And Billy Beane turned to these ideas and turned to his general approach of how to look at the game and employed these ideas and became the first.
Billy Beane himself had been just about, when he was a high school baseball player, just about the most highly recruited high school baseball player in the country. He had, the scouts said, boy, what a build he's got, what a swing he can throw, and it just never panned out for him.
Clearly, he did not live up to the expectations that those who recruited him had. He was taken in the very first round of the draft in 1980 by the Mets alongside Darryl Strawberry, their other first-round pick. The way I looked at it is that he was able to, you know, look back at what had happened in his case and learn something from it. Billy got very turned on by these alternative ideas, this other way of looking at the game that put much less stock in how the scouts had perceived the game and the traditional way that they had perceived the game, and more in these numbers. And it interested him doubly because not only did it represent a possible route to winning, but also it kind of explained him and his past. And maybe he hadn't failed because he didn't live up to his potential. Maybe he had failed because there had been unreasonable expectations put upon him. And with the second lowest payroll in baseball that year, 2002, he finds players who others either completely overlooked or were really undervaluing because they were too old or too funny looking, you know, too quirky or flawed.
The conventional wisdom was that they just weren't promising ball players and they were interchangeable parts.
Right. One example is Scott Hatteberg, who had ruptured a nerve in his elbow of his throwing arm. And so he couldn't feel half his arm and half of his fingers in his throwing hand. And he was a catcher, so that basically took him out of it, and he was released. But when they looked at his on-base percentage, how many pitches he saw, you know, his continued solid contact with the ball, the placement, stuff like that, you know, a semi-broken player, if you put him at first, a guy who had never played first, like how costly would that be? And they ran their numbers, and they believed that if they had nine guys as productive as him, if they had nine Scott Hattebergs, they could potentially take the whole thing. And now teams with money are adopting a lot of these ideas. I think the number of PhDs and data systems architects and statistical analysts that are in the game right now, I don't have the exact number, but I'm going to say that most teams now have their full-time, you know, analysts that are, I mean, even including the New York Yankees.
I can't imagine anyone wouldn't be anything but complimented by being portrayed by Brad Pitt. But do you have any idea how Billy Beane feels about the motion picture?
It's funny. You know, Billy is a very charismatic guy, very friendly guy, very, very easy to be in a room with him, very interesting. He's a really good hang. But you could also tell that there's something sort of intense and competitive inside him. You know, Billy Beane is a guy who thinks that he's trying to win baseball games. But I think that there was something going on also. You know, there was a great expectation put upon him as a player, and that ended up not panning out. You know, I think in his mind, he's trying to remedy something from the past. I think he thinks he's trying to win baseball games, but what he's really doing is he's embarked in this adventure that's going to lead him to value things differently, including his own life. And that's really what happens in the movie.
Bennett Miller directs the new motion picture Moneyball out this weekend. Mr. Miller, thanks so much.
Okay, man. Thank you.
One day a few years ago, Diego Stocco was sitting under a tree in his backyard, and he got an idea. Stocco is a composer and sound designer based in Burbank, California, and it didn't take him long to think, maybe I can make some music with this tree.
So I went inside the house, I grabbed my double bass bow, and I approached the tree, found the one twig that looked like a string, basically, and started to bow it. And I found that it worked, so I decided to put together an entire piece of music out of those sounds. I started with the rhythm by hitting the cortex and shaking the leaves. After I had that element, I started recording the bass drum, which basically was made by a customized version of a stethoscope where I connected a microphone to it. So I was able to capture these very low frequencies, and then I went on with the tweaks. And then I added and added until I felt I had enough takes that I could basically create the piece of music out of it.
Trees aren't your only organic instruments. You've also made music with sand, which is incredible. I want everybody to listen to this for a moment. This is music from sand. Is this all made from sand?
Yes, 100% from sand.
How is that possible?
Well, basically, the first thing was to record one note from the sand. And to do that, I put a contact microphone in the sand, and then I was either rubbing it or moving my hand inside this glass ball filled of sand. Then I took that note and I mapped it on a sampler. At that point, I was able to play multiple notes like you would do in a piano.
It's actually an incredibly beautiful sound, and it just makes you wonder what else is out there. I mean, the possibilities. You could, in theory, record anything, which I guess you've done. You even went to a dry cleaner and made this beautiful sound from a dry cleaner, and let's listen to some of that.
Basically, everything came from sounds that I either created by moving the machines or just by recording sounds that were happening in that environment. For example, the press machines have pedals and levers. It looks like a weird drum kit that you can play.
You grew up in Italy, Diego, mm-hmm. and you actually went to a music conservatory. I mean, you were accepted at the age of 11, and you attended, right?
It was a very brief appearance at the conservatory because they made me study the violin. I didn't want to study it, and so one day I got fed up with it, and I saw my violin in half. I put it in the... and so I went back to the school. And the teacher asked me, so did you study today? I said, well, there was a problem with the violin. So I opened the case of the violin, and he went, what happened to it? Well, I said, you know, I kind of saw it in half, you know. and so they made me basically, there's a test that they made you go through, and they can confirm you or not, and they just wanted to make me go through to kick me out, basically.
Diego Stocco, you now live in Southern California near the center of the movie industry, and some of your work has been featured in movies. You worked with Hans Zimmer on the soundtrack for Sherlock Holmes, and some of your work is actually, I understand, in the new film Contagion.
Yes, but in the specific case with Hans Zimmer, I got featured as a featured soloist, because I was playing an instrument that I built, and it's called Experibass. It's a combination of a double bass, a cello, a violin, and a viola, all together in the body of the double bass.
It's like a Frankenstein instrument.
Exactly, yes. I really love creating a sound first and the music after. So basically, it's the instrument that tells me what music I can play with it.
That's Diego Stocco. He's a composer and a sound designer based in Burbank, California. That's where he's been speaking to me from. Diego, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
You can watch how Diego makes these sounds at our website, npr.org.
And finally today, we're going back to school. And not just any school, but one that produced one of the greatest student ensemble bands of all time, the Kashmir High School Stage Band. At a time when segregationists were in the last days of influence and still doing their best to keep the races apart and black people out of the public eye, the band was winning national championships, recorded 8 albums, and did tours overseas, all while projecting a proud, funky, ethnic style. The band is now the focus of a music documentary titled Thunder Soul. It will be playing in select markets starting today. And joining us on the line to talk about this is Oscar-winning actor and Grammy Award-winning artist Jamie Foxx. He is the film's executive producer. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Let me just tell people a little bit about the story. The band came together under the guidance of music teacher Conrad Johnson, who the students affectionately called Prof. Let's listen to a clip.
When Prof put this band together, it was really not a standard to have an all-black band led by a black, you know, band director.
Competition back then, man, was predominant white. And I mean predominant white. And we was out there, an all-black band.
Conrad believed that there was no limit to a child's ability to play music. He'd set incredibly high goals for these kids. And Conrad inspired them to put everything into it.
Now, at the center of the film is a reunion of some of the high school band members who decide that they want to get back together after 35 years as a way to pay tribute to their music teacher, who at that time is 92 years old. And to be honest, they didn't really sound so great at first. Let's hear a short clip.
Some of these guys hadn't played in 30 years. When I say 30 years, I mean 30 years. You can't just pick up a trumpet and blow if you hadn't blown it. It just doesn't happen.
So how did you get involved with telling the story of the Kashmir High School Stage Band?
To be honest with you, the story had already been told, and it was already, you know, a documentary. And then, you know, just sort of like how Oprah Winfrey and Tyler Perry embraced Precious, I came on and embraced Thunderstorm, because I thought that the music component, which, you know, me being in the music community and friends that I have that are musicians, I said this would be a fantastic movie. And when you watch it, there's nothing but joy in your heart, and you're rooting for these guys. So I wanted to be able to say, listen, let's get as many eyes and as many people aware of this as we can, because things are happening. One, two, it helps keep the focus on young people in music.
Mm. You were a native of Texas. Did you know about Kashmir before you heard about this project, or was this all news to you?
I did not. It was all new for me. You know, and Texas is an interesting place because it's very big. And then there's a thing called Texas history when you're growing up as a kid. You know, if it didn't happen in Texas, it didn't really happen. So it's like some of these stories you never would know. But what I was also intrigued by was, imagine if we could now turn it into a movie and grab people like Cedric the Entertainer and Terrence Howard and myself and these young guys and put it together as a film. So,
are you going to do that?
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Tell folks what it is that was so distinctive about their sound.
Well, it was not just the sound. It's like, here's the marching band, and this is what you're supposed to do on the field. Most bands that were, you know, predominantly black schools and maybe didn't have all the instrumentation, the way they would sort of compensate is that they would dance or give a different type of show or a different type of move. In this situation, Prof was able to connect dots For one, he concentrated on the fact that when you're playing in the stage band, and that's what people have to understand, this is a movie about the stage band. When you're playing in the stage band, the music has to be absolutely 100% that even if they were looking at you, that the music was stellar. But then when he added the soul and the funk to it, that's what made them exciting. They even went on and made records back then, and people would listen to the records and would be blown away that these kids were in high school. And then after 30 years of being away from each other, and they knew that Prof, you know, was getting older, they all got back together to do a great performance for Prof. So that was the uniqueness of the story.
I just want to play one more, I think, very tender moment in the film where one of the band members visits Prof in the hospital after he suffered a mild heart attack, and he wants to tell him about the reunion. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
I got guys that haven't played their horns in 30 years that came back to do this deal.
What?
Yeah. 30 years.
Can they do it?
Prof, you will be amazed.
You mean they were... Now listen, I want you to hear what I'm saying.
Okay.
They were taught so well that they can remember what they did then and do it?
It's almost like you in the room, Prof.
I can't believe this.
It's just like you're standing there.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So I'd like to ask you, was there a Prof in your life?
Oh, man, several Profs. I mean, Miss Willie, Miss Barbara Willie, who was my choir teacher, Miss Brown, who was also my choir teacher. And then there was a lady by the name of Lenita Hodge. My grandmother, Estelle Talley, lived in Terrell, Texas. Lenita Hodge lived in Dallas, and we would have to drive to Dallas to do our music lessons. She says, why don't you come to Terrell on a Saturday, and I'll let you use my house, and you can teach everybody in Terrell that wants to come play the piano if you can allow my son to have a couple of lessons that are for free. She really taught me discipline, and then I went on from there to go on to college on a classical piano scholarship. So there were several Profs in my life.
One of the points that you've made is that you really want to help people understand the importance of arts education and having the arts as a vehicle for kids to express themselves. And one of the other things I think is important to note about this is a time when, you know, Prof really let the kids express themselves in their style.
Yeah.
You know, they wore the afros, they wore their hair the way they wanted to wear it.
Yeah.
But he also stood up for the discipline of music and learning it. And as you pointed out, the music had to be tight as well as their sort of performance. Let's hear a short clip. Do you think that kids do understand the importance of the discipline, that people, communities understand the importance of the discipline that you learn from music and all that it brings?
First thing that I learned was that it actually helps a kid learn how to read faster. Because once you're learning how to read notes, you start that developing that muscle of recognition and execution. You never know what a kid may pick up. Now, not every kid is going to go away and be, you know, Miles Davis or be Chopin or Mozart, but it gives them something to work towards and it gives them, inspiration.
Jamie Foxx is the executive producer of the music documentary Thunder Soul. It opens in select markets today, and it has a wider release next month. Jamie Foxx, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We are going to leave you with some more music from the Kashmir Stage Band.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff. The executive producer is Sarah Saracen. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.